This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jeff Smith sitting in. We are honored to be joined by Jody Jacobson, President and Editor-in-Chief of Rewired.News. Jody Jacobson, how you doing? Jody, you there?
I am here, yeah.
Hello, good afternoon. Is it afternoon or morning where you are?
It is afternoon.
All right, well.
Eastern time, yeah.
Good afternoon. How are you holding up?
Okay, how are you doing?
I'm holding up. What are you paying attention to most closely? Let's talk about Kavanaugh for a moment and about the state of the national conversation. What are you focused on most closely now, and what do you hope that more and more people in the country will be focused on?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to focus on with respect to the nomination and the process, but I think that right now we're looking for two things. We've noted that the Senate Judiciary Committee has completely and utterly waived its responsibility in terms of vetting this candidate. He's lied under oath. He's basically committed perjury. He's had, you know, evasive responses to a number of incredibly important issues. And they've just kind of let that go by as though it didn't matter at all. And, of course, the second piece is now the alleged attempted rape of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, who came out, as you know, about a week ago now with her experience. And the way that this has been handled just underscores the craven nature of the GOP. If they were really concerned about sexual assault and sexual harassment, they would take it seriously, they would have the FBI investigate, and then act on those findings, whether or not Kavanaugh was cleared. But they are going out of their way to avoid an FBI investigation, which tells me there's something wrong, and they're spinning all sorts of conspiracy theories while at the same time attacking her credibility, creating conditions in which her safety and security are at risk. She's had to go into hiding with her family. It's the same GOP playbook, except, you know, with more high-tech tools at their disposal in terms of the internet and the kinds of ways that she's been threatened. So we're watching now for the next steps of Dr. Blasey Ford's team. Her visibility in public and availability and her safety, those are the things of the greatest concern, and her ability to testify under conditions that allow her to tell her story and have an actual investigation of the claim.
And I don't know if I was going to ask some questions about Kavanaugh, but I don't want to just sort of center the dude in the story. What words do you have for us with respect to Dr. Blasey Ford? And I saw Donald Trump's, I think probably listeners saw Donald Trump's tweets attacking her credibility this morning. His house is so glass, he should not be allowed to possess stones when it comes to credibility. But what do you know that she is dealing with in addition? I mean, she's had death or she's had to leave her house. What do you hope that she does, or what do you hope that others do with or for her?
Well, you know, we know Donald Trump to be who he is. Let's face it, the guy is himself a sexual harasser and potential sexual assault perpetrator. Also, you know, supported Roy Moore, has had abusers in his White House, knowing they were abusers. We could go on. So his comments are both expected and disgusting at the same time. What I hope for her, and I happen to know her legal team, they are excellent at their, in this field. They're the premier legal firm that deals with sexual assault and sexual harassment cases. We're not seeing by on purpose, you know, an Avenatti-style drama unfolding in public. What they are doing is very carefully negotiating the terms under which Dr. Blasey Ford would be able to testify and able to get the kind of investigation she wants. And testify under the conditions that she sets. So they are working really diligently to do that, and I'm confident in her team. I also know that there are a team of incredibly smart feminist politicos that are working with her and comms people that are working with her. So what I think we'll see is Dr. Blasey Ford becoming, you know, coming out in public under her terms, which is the way it should be, because she is the alleged victim here. We shouldn't be putting her on trial. We shouldn't be questioning her steps forward into the public eye. We should be allowing her to come into the public space in the way she wants. That's how sexual assault victims should be treated. If you are taking what is known as a trauma-informed approach to these kinds of things, that's not what the GOP wants, because we've seen they want to support Kavanaugh under any circumstances, no matter what. What I hope people do to support Dr. Blasey Ford is to make sure that in their own circles, wherever they are, if they are at work or in personal circles or in other public spheres, and they are having conversations about this, that they fight back on victim blaming. That's the first thing. We know victims often come forth much later after an assault has happened for very important reasons. I also hope people will consider donating to the fund approved by her legal team and now co-sponsored by Alyssa Milano, Vote Pro Choice, and a range of other groups, because she needs financial support. She's got security costs. She's had to relocate and hide her family. She's got legal bills. She's got transportation costs. There's a lot going on here that's suddenly been thrust on her. And in a way, when you think about it, she is fighting this fight for virtually every woman in this country who is either a victim of sexual assault or harassment or could potentially be, because she is basically taking a stand against having a potential sexual assault perpetrator on the Supreme Court. And there's really no way to overstate what she's undertaking here.
Take us inside a little bit, the negotiations, to the extent that you either know or can kind of understand the negotiating point. So things that have already come out that have been reported are that she wanted to, and through her lawyer also, wanted there to be an FBI investigation in advance. So far, the Trump administration has been unwilling to do as the Reagan administration was willing to do and have an FBI investigation. Wouldn't take all that long. Not that many witnesses to talk to, but she has requested that FBI investigation. The key thing about the FBI investigation is lying to the FBI is a crime, and therefore, if Kavanaugh were to talk to the FBI, if anybody else who was a witness talked to the FBI, if they weren't truthful and if that were provable, they will have just committed a crime. But in addition to that, we've heard there was a request for actual senators to ask questions rather than there to be outside counsel. Why is that point important, or any other thing in our last 30 seconds that you think people ought to be watching for as these negotiations unfold?
So I don't pretend to have inside knowledge of the day-to-day of the negotiations, but I do think we should be watching for, making sure that the senators themselves are put on the spot to question her, because they've been assailing her character and they should have to face her. Two, we should be putting political pressure to have an FBI investigation. And three, we should make sure that she gets the terms of the hearing that she wants.
Can you stick with us after the break for just a moment?
Sure.
Thank you so much. Jody Jacobson from Rewire.news. She's the chief of it. I'm Jeff, sitting in for Tom Hartman. We're going to be right back after this.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to be right back after these messages. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, and you're watching it on Free Speech TV, and thanks for doing that. Continuing with Jody Jacobson of Rewire.news, Jody Jacobson talking about the implications of the Kavanaugh hearings and what that will have not only on the Supreme Court, but also on the discussion around sexual assault, around how we move against a culture of misogyny, how each of us who played our own role in that culture can come to grips with it and have a world that bends the arc of history at least a little bit more towards justice. Jody was just speaking about the about some of the points that are important in the negotiation. One that was just made was making sure senators themselves ask the questions. Jody, any other negotiating points that you think ought to be or you think are important to the Blasey Ford legal team or to she herself?
Well, I think that it's really important that they insist that Mark Judge, who is a friend of Brett Kavanaugh's and who Dr. Ford names as the other person who is witness to this and actually participated in some level, be at that hearing and be sworn under oath to testify. That is a critical issue, and the fact, again, that he doesn't want to testify and that the Republicans are not subpoenaing him to do so is yet another indication that they're not very interested in the truth. Because let's face it, if they knew that Brett Kavanaugh was not guilty, they could have called for an investigation by the FBI on Monday, had it cleared by Wednesday, and we wouldn't be having this conversation. So it's just remarkable to me how much guilt is hanging out here, given how much pushback there is on any investigation. And yesterday, one of the White House's political hacks and a friend of Kavanaugh's and others floated some conspiracy theory that it was actually someone who looks like Brett Kavanaugh who did this alleged assault, and that they should be looking elsewhere. I mean, these people are nuts, and they think that we're all stupid, and we are not. So I think that really, again, the public has to be engaged in pushing their senators to do the right thing here, because here's one woman literally going up against the force of the entire right-wing machinery on behalf of all of us. This is a heroic level of mental strength and emotional strength, and I think we all have to appreciate that and support her.
What questions would you ask Kavanaugh? Maybe what question would you hope get asked to Dr. Is it Dr. Blasey Ford or just Dr. Ford?
I think either is correct, but we've been using her own name.
Okay. Because as I thought about the kind of architecture of the argument, and in the current political time, that there are a number of arguments they can use, and we've heard all of them at, we've heard three or four that I've thought of, that I've seen, rather, in the last days. So one possible argument is she's making it up, she's dishonest. Another argument is that she's confused. Another argument is it doesn't matter, it was a long time ago. And the other is it might matter, but he's come clean and gotten better. They don't use the last one because he has denied it. If you're willing to stick with us right after this quick break, do we have to go to a hard break now or do we go right back? Okay, yeah, if you'd stick with us for a little bit, I want to get into the questions that you hope get asked, how we can make some sense of this. Jody Jacobson, I'm Jeff. This is The Tom Show. We'll be right back. You're listening to The Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jeff sitting in, and we are honored to be joined by Jody Jacobson, President and Editor-in-Chief of Rewire.News. Jody, you've been very generous with your time, and thank you for that. What are the arguments that you've seen or that you anticipate from the Republicans on the Senate committee and their assorted apparatus?
I think they are going to try to discredit Dr. Blasey Ford, and I think that's one reason they want a woman to do this. You know, they had this idea that they were going to have their female staffers interrogate her rather than the senators themselves, and there's only one reason for that. Now they're thinking of bringing in outside counsel, but there's only one reason for that. This is a group of men. There's not one single woman senator on the Republican side of the House of the Senate Judiciary Committee. There never has been a woman senator on that committee from the Republican side. There are four on the Democratic side. So having 80-year-old Chuck Grassley and his counterpart Orrin Hatch, both of whom have discredited her in their own comments already, questioning her is not a very good look for the Republicans, especially since it plays against the, you know, video from 27 years ago of those two same men discrediting Anita Hill. So you've got this, they've put themselves in a really tight spot, and they're trying to get out of it by changing the characters on the, you know, on the of the prosecutors, let's say. So they'll try to discredit her. They will try to say she's confused. They will pull out every trick in the book. They've already started to, as I said earlier, using these conspiracy theories that they're floating out there, that, you know, there's somebody else involved who looks like him, and so forth. I think the Democrats really need to take this to Brett Kavanaugh, because, again, he has lied under oath already several times about other issues, which I personally believe should be disqualified for a Supreme Court justice. I mean, but our standards have fallen so far. But, you know, I really want to know. There was questioning of him by Chuck Grassley about his youthful indiscretions. And if you watch that tape, you know that they were trying to preset something. So I believe they may have known about this before. So I think the Democrats really need to delve into what was prepared in order to stave off this coming out, which they may have known about. Was he involved in some of these conspiracy theories that we now know are now coming out because they link to him? In other words, the people who are spreading them are linked to him. There are a whole range of questions apart from where he was. Was he there? Did he know Dr. Ford? You know, I'm not on the Judiciary Committee, so I'm not involved in the preparation. I don't know all of the evidence they have. I can't really articulate what the most critical questions could be, but I do know that those are the things that, at a minimum, should be asked.
There was an article that, was it in Salon Slate? I forget. This is the accusation that men have feared the most. I was talking to a colleague of mine, actually, she's my boss, and who was saying, well, the thing is, and she was saying how much more of this happens, how many more men have, and I've talked about on this show about, you know, not shielding my own self. I mean, like the toxic masculinity that I and friends of mine have been part of in our lives, and that we, and I don't want to sort of center men in this. I don't think like taking care of them is the most important thing we've got to do at this moment in history. But I do still have the question for those men who are being quiet at this moment because they don't want to throw stones because they think they themselves live in a glass house. What would be your advice, if you're willing, to them?
It doesn't
have to be anything.
I've heard stories of women who have come forth to say that they've been approached by people who have assaulted or attempted assault or harassed them in the past with heartfelt apologies. I think that is one approach. If you have something, let's, you know, just say that's heavy on your heart, so to speak, then maybe one thing to do is to seek forgiveness from the person in question. You know, I think we'd be in a very different place had Kavanaugh said, hey, I drank too much in high school and I did this and, you know, I'm really sorry. But his history is one of misogynistic legal decisions and misogynistic behavior. He claims, for example, not to have known anything about the sexual harassment, rampant sexual harassment that went on in the chambers of Judge Kaczynski, with whom he is very close. That's kind of creepy because everybody else knew about it. How did he miss it? So I think he's a guy who has been given a pass for basically everything in order to carry the water for the far right wing. And I don't know that many men fit that description, but many men, I know many men that have never committed assault, and of the men who have, I think, you know, they need to figure out how they own their own behavior. I would say that's the most important thing.
Very helpful. Joe Jacobson, we've got 30 seconds before break. Anything you want to plug or any insight, anything I should have asked that I didn't?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I appreciate you taking the time to talk about this. And, you know, we do cover this regularly with lots of legal and other analysis at rewire.news. So we'd love for your listeners to visit our site and read our stuff.
On Twitter, what's your Twitter handle? JL Jacobson?
Yes.
And at rewire_news and rewire.news. Thank you so much for being with us, Jody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You listen to Tom Hartman Show. We'll be back with your calls after this break. We've got calls coming up on electoral votes, on free trade capitalists, on yes on Kavanaugh, on gasoline, on the Republicans generally. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
This is the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jeff sitting in. Hey, everybody. This is the Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jeff Smith. Thanks for being with us. You've been waiting patiently on the phones. Let's go to Michael. Actually, yeah, let's go to Michael because I said his name. I want to talk about electoral votes. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, actually, it's about senators, Jefferson. Okay. I'll start off with facts. Wyoming, 579,000 people. North Dakota, 755,000. South Dakota, 869,000. Montana, 1.5. Idaho, 1.7 million. Nebraska, 1.92 million. Combined, that's roughly 7 million people. They got 12 senators. California, roughly 30 million people, 2 senators. Now, we know who the red states are owned by. It's called the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers' ultimate dream is a constitutional crisis, which would lead to a rewriting of the Constitution. Now, you're a lawyer, Jefferson. If that crisis is created, who would be entrusted to rewrite a new constitution? Would it be the Supreme Court, or would it be the Senate and the House? Or if you have any idea, who would be entrusted?
We should get Larry Lessig, who is an old friend, who's a law professor, and to talk about, because he has advocated for calling a limited constitutional convention. The constitutional convention can be called based on the call for the convention, can decide the scope of that convention. And so that question wouldn't go to the Supreme Court. And so I do want to, before I spout further, I want to look a little more in, or maybe get in a guest who's looked at the specifics really recently. But I want to underscore the point you made. And here's data you can check, but I think I'm right, that half the country right now, half the population of the country, is represented by 18 out of 100 U.S. senators. I think if you add up California, Texas, New York, probably Illinois, Florida, and I'm missing four states, if you add up the most populous 9 states, that's about half the country. That means the other half the country gets 82 U.S. senators. And right now, this is why I think how we advocate for democracy, how do we advocate for a system where, in fact, the people govern? To me, that is the most important argument we have to be making. And I'll give you one more piece of evidence, one little data point that it is. So Claire McCaskill had to struggle politically with whether or not to support Kavanaugh. She represents a state that voted for Trump. Many of those people voted for Trump did it not in spite of, but absolutely because he would appoint someone like Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And she said, uh-oh, how do I deal with this? And what has she said the reason wasn't Roe versus Wade? She didn't say it was anything about Kavanaugh's personal life. She said it was about dark money. She said it was about Kavanaugh's views about democracy, that she recognized with her best political analysis that the argument that she could use in a red state as a Democratic big D member of the U.S. Senate, the argument she could use was, in fact, democracy. This, to me, for people who are casting about for what is both the base note that can resonate amidst the cacophonous treble and the thing that more specifically or more immediately can be used by somebody in a in a tricky race, the theme morally and politically is democracy. So I'm gonna look up, but the quick answer to your question is, yeah, you could call a constitutional convention for a narrow purpose. There are some who argued that that once that was started, it could be thrown open, and you might then have a call for a broad constitutional convention. And if the challenge of the constitutional convention under the Constitution, you'd have the same authority that still gives small states and not just majoritarian concerns sway would come into play, which is why so many even pro-democracy advocates are nervous about a broad open convention. But Michael, thank you for the call. I will look more into that, and I hope you'll call again and hold us accountable. David from Connecticut, go ahead, speak your piece.
Hey, Jeff, thanks for taking my call. I love it when you're on.
Thanks, man.
I just want to present a narrative that I think should be broadcast nationally on mainstream television, but it's not going to happen. When we got Trump, the Republicans made a very, very dark deal with the billionaire class of this nation. And they will accept all the chaos, all the wackiness, all the misogyny, racism, all of it, you know, for their two Supreme Court justices that they're going to get and that $1.5 trillion tax break. And how the Democrats become complicit in this is why they don't fight harder in saying this on the mainstream press, that this is the bargain that the Republicans have made. And you know what, Jeff? They don't say this because they have inadvertently become part of that bargain when you figure out yesterday that 97 people in the Senate, all the Democrats except Bernie Sanders, voted for that horrendous military budget of almost $700 billion. And you know what, Jeff? A lot of women and girls somewhere around the world are going to catch some major hell because of what we're going to unleash on them with all that money. And that this gets under my skin, Jeff, and I want to know what you think, if I'm crazy or not. Thanks a lot, Jeff.
David, thank you for calling. David, if you haven't hung up.
Yeah, I haven't hung up.
Yeah, ask your question again about what you are accusing Republicans, as my note here says, Republican the billionaire donors, of doing. I want to make sure I respond to the question as you're asking it.
Well, what I'm accusing them of is they blatantly made a bargain with the billionaire class, the Edelmans, the Koch brothers, that, sure, you know, we're going to put up with all this stuff, this wackiness of the White House, all of it, because we don't care if this woman's telling the truth. They don't give a damn at all. With the bargain, they're going to get their two people on the court, and they're going to get their $1.5 trillion tax break, and that's it. And that's all. They don't care about anything, about any of this. And we got to stop thinking that way. And to reform this, we've got to somehow drag the Democrats along, who are voting for $700 billion military budgets that are going to allow women and girls all around the world to catch some serious hell. So everybody's complicit, yeah. Jeff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And when I talk to people, they look at me like I got three eyes. But maybe you can understand what I'm saying.
Here's what I would say. That I go further than the Republicans have made a deal with the billionaire class. All right, everybody runs for office. I shouldn't say everybody. Nearly everybody runs for office who end up getting elected to the U.S. Senate has to raise a bunch of money, and almost none of them raise all their money. I mean, you've got Beto in Texas who's not taking PAC money, but almost no U.S. senator is elected without raising lots of money, including lots of money at the federal maximum. And any contested race, any close race, will also get floods of essentially secret money and independent expenditures that aren't subject to the same limits as hard money contributions to the Senate candidates. I think it's deeper than just they're in cahoots. In an important way, it is of the same thing. It's not like there's a handful of people over here and a handful of people over there and they shook hands and say, hey, let's do this thing together. It's that is the thing. When we've talked about Nancy McLean's book, Democracy in Chains, as I give my sort of simplified version of her exegesis of political history, the way I would say it is right now the battle is more obvious. It's been clear for a while, but it's more obviously now ownership versus democracy. Property versus people. It's not left versus right. That cheapens it. That binary view of the political dynamic itself is a tool of oppression. That from the days of John C. Calhoun arguing in favor of property rights, that they were just and right, and the property rights he was talking about were slavery, to then James Buchanan, not the president, arguing in favor of privatization of stuff, specifically schools, in the wake of Brown versus Board of Education, to make sure that there didn't need to be democracy infiltrating schools so that, in fact, the tools of government would require white kids and black kids to go to the same schools. To then the Koch brothers taking those ideas and spreading them and taking over the Republican Party that had been, yes, the party of Abraham Lincoln and then the party of Theodore Roosevelt, who have their own sins to be sure, but did important things to bend the arc of history towards at least the 21st century or the 20th century, that the argument that we've got to make is, in fact, in favor of people, not just property, in favor of democracy, not just ownership. And that is tied up, of course, into patriarchal wealth. That is what we fought the revolution over, was whether or not accident of birth, whether or not inherited wealth, was the kind of thing that ought to wield power. If all property came from God through something inside someone's blue-veined blood, and then that spread to their progeny, and therefore they got to wield the army and control everybody else's economics and make all the decisions. Even before we were deciding and even had the modern awareness about what was happening with women and people of color, we hadn't broadened our perspective. At least then there was an awareness that, you know what, power shouldn't just be determined by property. It shouldn't just be determined by ownership. Democracy and people should be things that matter. And now the truth of the matter is, when we realize, oh, democracy doesn't just mean white dudes. I don't speak for you, but I recognize that's who I am. Democracy means the whole crew, and not just people who identify themselves with a particular binary gender. And if that's what it's going to take, if that's what democracy is, that's who people are, then yeah, things are going to change in terms of who wields power. And that is absolutely what is going on. This isn't merely a right-left thing. And I don't think it's just a few people shaking some hands to make a deal. That is what their movement is about, because they recognize, and it gets back to the caller before that, they recognize that that view doesn't have majority support in the country. That you put that on the ballot and it doesn't win. That ultimately people don't really want just a few people to control things based on how much money they got. That's not how people want the world to work. And for the people who have that much money, they have got to subvert or put democracy in chains to continue to rule. That's what's going on. Not just right or left, but forward and up. This is the Tom Hartman Show.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
This is Tom Hartman Show. I'm Jeff. Charles, you're on from Prescott Valley, Arizona on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind?
Yes, hi. Well, back to Kavanaugh, I guess. What I was kind of set off by your previous guest, I guess, Jody Jacobson.
Yeah.
Professor Ford is dealing with piggish committee members, Republican committee members, who don't respect diligence or truth or politeness, and certainly these are attributes I think that characterize her current legal team also. She needs a junkyard dog in her corner like Michael Abernathy, and I think Jody made some negative remark about him. He could have the nation focus on the Republicans' degenerative criminal mindset. And I assume Michael Abernathy might do this pro bono in respect to her hearing. And if Kavanaugh came in the room and he was sitting at the table with Professor Ford, I'm sure he'd wet his pants.
Well, I hear you, and I hear your point that what Dr. Ford needs is not politeness, is the point that I think you were making and that you made even prior to getting on the phone. I really appreciate your call. And I don't view myself as the final arbiter. A point that I heard that makes it a little bit different from the Abernathy context that I really appreciate from Jody Jacobson was somebody who is that approaching this issue from a trauma-informed perspective. And this is new information to me, and I feel like sort of a dum-dum for not being aware of it for more of my life. But recognizing that that much of Avenatti's point, much of Stormy Daniels' point, is that Stormy Daniels was the woman who was acting with agency. When she was with Donald Trump, she was acting with agency. That she did not view herself as a victim of abuse. She has felt herself as a victim of lies and verbal and legal and financial abuse since, but that is a different context. The context with Dr. Blasey Ford is a context of trauma. For those of us who experience trauma, who have been hit when we were kids, I'm one of them, who have caused harm to others, I'm one of them, that dealing in that context is a little bit different. And I'm not going to, again, consider myself the expert on those matters, but I do want to make sure to shine a light on her point, which I didn't take as, hey, we got to be nice, but rather we got to come from a trauma-informed perspective. And it'd be interesting to bring on some more people who could talk about that. Charles, if you wanted to finish your point, go ahead. Otherwise, I want to go to another caller.
Yes, I did. I think in this instance, the main point is certainly the trauma, but the committee doesn't give a damn about that, and that's the whole point. I think they need somebody to expose them and their attitudes, and I think this would be a perfect forum for Michael Avenatti, and I'm sure he'd like to raise his public profile, but that's okay. You know, as long as he, you know, is pointing the finger at them and making the point, and I think that there'd be more people nationally that would pick up on that.
Yep.
and to expose these Republicans for what they are.
I hear you, Charles. We'll give that as the last word. Thank you so much for calling. I'm Jeff Smith. Honored to be with you on the Tom Hartman Show. We got more coming up just now. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Jeff Smith. You're you. It's Friday. It's in Minnesota and maybe elsewhere, International Peace Day. It is also the last day of summer. I know this, my view is not borne by science or fact or tradition, but I think summer ends with the beginning of September. That is my view. And I think the idea that September 19th is still summer, that I'm not down. I'm not down with it. I am engaging in my own alternative truth, but the people who know things say summer starts tomorrow. We're with you. And right now we are also with Luke Vargas from Talk Media News, talkmedianews.com. Luke, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday. It's Anything Goes Friday. What do you have to go?
Well, the thing I've been watching the most this week, with in the wake of this new refugee admissions cap that was placed at a very low number, the lowest in 40 years, by the administration on Monday, has been some reporting coming out just today from NBC, which suggests that Stephen Miller, the White House whisperer on immigration, who really seems to be pulling a lot of levers, was able to exclude Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, and Mark Green, the administrator of USAID, our Agency for International Development, from a meeting last Friday where this refugee cap was finalized, which directly, you know, this report calls into serious question what Sarah Sanders and the spokespeople at the U.S. State Department have been saying, which is, look, you know, all of the relevant voices in the administration who are setting foreign policy and humanitarian policy were rigorously consulted on this 30,000 refugee cap for next year. And, you know, we had a meeting and we all agreed. It turns out the people who would have disagreed were barred from even being there. And this sort of puts, I mean, I think many people have been focused on Stephen Miller and his ability to always keep the president's attention on immigration issues and push him even further sometimes than Trump is inclined to go on his own, but sort of puts him on par with the reputations of people like John Bolton, who have been very famous in their tenure in the U.S. government for figuring out who the sort of levers of decision-making power are, and if they contradict him, figuring out ways to work the system, to plant ideas in the chief of staff's head and things like that, or just block people from meetings through other means. And I think here Stephen Miller quite savvily making sure voices who probably are opposed to the U.S. scaling back its refugee commitments, making sure they weren't even there in the room when the decision was made.
So the remind people the cap that was put on, and then put that in context of how much lower that cap is than in previous years.
Okay. Before we talk about next year's cap, let's say this fiscal year 2018, which is about to draw to an end at the end of the month, we had allotted for 45,000 people to possibly come. That was the cap. And we don't always hit that cap. Sometimes we actually, overdo it, but not in recent history. And so even though we said 45 for this year, as of right now, we've only let in about 21,000. So we're well below the stated number, and I think you will expect that to continue. But that wasn't good enough. The new cap for next year is 30,000. So we're taking it formally down another 15,000, and we'll probably, again, fall far short of that. Compare this to 115,000, which was the last fiscal year that President Obama got to set, and you can see this overall number is going way down. And I will also point out that you have seen, since Trump came into office, an 80% reduction in the number of Muslims being allowed to come into the United States. One report finding that Christians now constitute almost 71% of all refugees coming into this country. Here at the United Nations, the U.S., and countries like Hungary, which is an accidental host for this kind of event, have been sponsoring things for next week's U.N. General Assembly, where they're specifically highlighting the plight of Christian minority groups that are fleeing conflict. It seems like we've just completely moved on from countries like Somalia or Syria, where Muslims are fleeing conflict, and where this administration is been looking for Syrians or for Christians instead. I think one anecdote was that there are more folks from Moldova coming into the United States as refugees every year than from Syria, which, given the size of that conflict, is obviously an extraordinary omission if you're just trying to capture the neediest people. So, again, I think you've got to look at the overall number is probably something Stephen Miller is very proud of, and then that 80% reduction in Muslim refugees is certainly not an accident.
The Obama administration, as I understand it, had raised that cap as high as 110,000. I think now in 2019, it's going to go down to, I think you said, 30,000.
Correct.
How does that compare with maybe per capita? I don't know if that's a fair way to do it. And by the way, any comparison to other countries that don't have the Statue of Liberty in the New York Harbor is maybe not apt. But what do you? How does that compare with other large nations, or per capita, or by some other comparison?
You have just outstripped me of my level of preparedness on this topic.
I would like to quiz you on other arcane matters of international law and see just how deep the knowledge goes.
Look, later today I am actually interviewing three different people in a little round table to dig into these numbers. So if you and I have the chance to talk next week, or if it's with Tom, we'll get into much more detail about that.
But, I would, and forgive me, my purpose wasn't to put you on the spot,
sure.
but I am trying not to see everything in the world through a jaundiced partisan eye. Okay, and I know that Stephen Miller's objective and the news you offered is really helpful, that Stephen Miller was in the room, but who wasn't in the room were people who might have argued otherwise. But as we talk about like China-U.S. Trade negotiations, understanding that, if Trump did it, therefore it's bad, but like, how do we put it in some context? Well, understanding the context of 110,000 to 30,000, Christian keeping out Muslims, maybe that's all we need to know, but I do find the context interesting. Anything, what may come of this, what may happen next, or anything else you want to cover before they cut us off?
Yeah, I know we have about 30 seconds. Let me just build on one thing you were just saying there, which is that the administration's explanation for this is, look, we talk to refugees. They don't want to go to Buffalo. They just want money close to where they are, material support. So that's the kind of excuse you need to give to justify this policy, it seems.
Luke Vargas, Doc Media News, you have a delightful voice. I am proud to share airtime with you, and thank you for calling.
Well, let's do it again. Take care.
Talk to you soon, Luke. This is the Tom Hartman Show. This is your favorite substitute teacher. I hope, Jeff Smith. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.